your spirit once again. Jesus, I just want to hear you calling out my name, saying, well done, good and faithful one. Well done today.
I should clarify, I'm not going to take 6 weeks to get through Ruth. I'm only going to do this in 2 weeks because I'm going to do my two chapters a week thing, and everybody else only gets one class. You guys will get into the book of 1 Samuel, for Pete's sake. How about that? So, we're in the book of Ruth. Though the book of Ruth doesn't tell us who the author is, Jewish tradition is that it was written probably by Samuel, the prophet, who's probably penned most of the next two books, 1 and 2 Samuel. It reads like a companion piece to 1 and 2 Samuel. And the more you get familiar with these books, you'll see it kind of has the same flavor, the same taste. We're going to pick it up in chapter 1, verse 1. Now it came to pass in the days when the judges ruled that there was a famine in the land. And a certain man of Benjamin, Judah, went, a certain man of Bethlehem, Judah, went to dwell in the country of Moab, he and his wife and his two sons. It says this story takes place when the judges ruled. And so it takes place historically within the book of Judges, that last book that we just finished, which covers the time period between when Joshua has brought the people in and conquered the land, between that point and between the point where the kings start to rule, which is what will start happening in 1 Samuel. So that's the period of Judges. It's a period of 400 years. We'd probably put it about 100 years before the end of it, because as you're going to see, there is some connections between what will happen in this book and what takes place in the beginning because this is the great-grandparents of David. And so we've got a connection with the next book. Some have suggested that I'm wondering if maybe this could have even been taking place possibly around the time of Samson. Possibly. Because when we went through Judges, Judges isn't a completely chronological book. And we think that probably the last of the Judges, there's a good chance it was Samson. It says it takes place in Bethlehem. The word Bethlehem, I'm going to give you some definitions this evening. Oh, boy. My monster drink is running out of my caffeine. I'm getting a caffeine low here. We're going to give you some definitions. Hebrew words, Hebrew names carry meaning. They carry significance. I got to confess, sometimes we make too much of it. And sometimes we make stuff up that isn't there because we're trying to make, it's like the person that's, studying, current English literature, and they come across the word dandelion, and they say, dandelion, well, that comes from the French, meaning, see, dandy means from the French for tooth, and lion, a lion's tooth. So the child went out and picked a lion's tooth. Oh, my goodness. We come up with the goofiest thing sometimes when we deal with etymology. But Hebrew itself, the Hebrews themselves, make something out of the names. There will be connections made where they will describe Abraham's name is changed. Why? Because there's purpose. There's something in the name. Abraham's son is named Isaac. Yitzhak, which means laughter. Why? Because they laugh. They just had to laugh when God said they were going to have a kid. 100 years old, you're going to have a kid. Oh, yeah, that's the craziest thing I ever heard. And they ended up calling the kid laughter. So there is something to the meanings. Bethlehem, the name Beth, when you see B-E-T-H, or in current Israeli maps, you'll see Beit, B-E-I-T. It's the same word. It means house. Lechem is the word for bread. Beth Lechem, Beth, house of bread. Bethlehem, and we learned this on our trip to Israel just this last November. This was so cool to have this stuff kind of unpacked for you. Bethlehem lies geographically at a line in Israel where from where they are to the north, there's vegetation. From where they are south, there's rocks and desert. So the shepherds wandering the wilderness, they wander up towards Bethlehem, and suddenly there's, you know, you can plant stuff here. You can grow stuff here. There's bread here. So Bethlehem, that's what the name means. And actually, that will kind of weave a little bit into our story.
What we can see from here is the move from the desert, from the wilderness.
This is last November.
Stone.
See, down in the south,
the
desert.
Red.
You see where the green starts?
Very exact view right here where you can see the place where they can begin to cultivate. You can see the cultivation. The soil gets a little better as you go up. We see an olive grove all the way through here, and you see homes and trees. So this is exactly the move from the desert to the settled land. It's just the way that the shepherds would have taken after they saw the angels telling them about the birth of Jesus as they went up to Bethlehem to the place of the nativity. I wanted you to get this very spot so you could keep this in your mind.
So this kind of plays into our story. This takes place around the house of bread. And it says that there's a famine, and so this man takes his family and they go to Moab. The Moabites were the descendants of Abraham's nephew Lot. He had an incestuous thing with his daughters. Messy story. The Bible's filled with messy stories. This is in Genesis 19. And both of his daughters, because Sodom and Gomorrah got wiped out, and they thought they were the last three people alive on the earth. So the daughters cook up this plan. We got to keep the human race going. Let's get Dad drunk, and he won't know what's happening. And they slept with him, and they both got pregnant. The Moabites and the Ammonites come from this relationship. Now, so the Moabites are part of that. They're kind of related to the Jews, to the Israelites, kinda. They're kind of distant cousins. These are the folks that give Israel a difficult time when they're going through the wilderness, coming into the promised land. These are the ones that where Balak, the Moabite king, hires Balaam to put a curse on the Israelites. Remember that story? And so Bethlehem is on the western side of the Jordan. Moab is on the eastern side of the Jordan. If we were to travel from Bethlehem to Moab, it kind of depends on exactly where they land in Moab, but the closest place is about 25 miles away. They're climbing these kinds of hills, going through these kinds of hills and valleys on their way to go to Moab. To the right is the Dead Sea. That's that bluish area. You see a darkish area down in the valley. That's the Jordan River. And on the other side of the Jordan River, it's plains of Moab, and everything to the right and a little bit to the left is where the Moabites are. So Elimelech takes his family and they leave Bethlehem because there's a famine, and they go off to Moab. And it says that there was a famine at this time. You got to remember, gang, that even in dark times, that there's future, there's a hope. God is at work, even in the dark times. I know a couple of you are going through some really dark times, not because it's like a word of knowledge or something, but I know you, that's why, and I talk to you. And I know what some of you are going through. God is at work in the dark times. And in this famine, people are dying behind the scenes. God is at work. In the same way in your life, we think it's the end of the world. And for some things, it is. Sometimes difficult things are the end of some kind of a world. But it's not the end of our world. God is at work. The period of the judges were some of the most bleakest in Israel's history. The last couple stories at the end of the book of Judges shows how great the depravity was going on. And what's even crazier is that, I don't know if you recall this, Joe, you'd recall this, that even the last couple stories about the Levite's wife and all that kind of messy stuff and the tribe of Dan getting their perverted idol worship, remember how much of it was connected to Bethlehem? Even while the nation is slipping downhill, God is at work. While the nation is involved in horrible things, a family is growing. God's preparing the way for a family, for David's family. The same family would bring another miracle to the world, a better miracle. Micah 5:2, but you, Bethlehem Ephratah, this place where the famine is, but you, Bethlehem Ephratah, though you are little among the thousands of Judah, yet out of you shall come forth to me the one to be ruler in Israel, whose goings forth are from of old, from everlasting. Jesus will come from Bethlehem. Jesus will come from this place where the world is falling apart. Even in dark times, God is at work. Verse 2. Let's do another verse. The name of the man was Elimelech. The name of his wife was Naomi. And the names of his two sons were Mahlon and Chilion, or Chilion, Ephrathites of Bethlehem, Judah. And they went to the country of Moab and remained there. Now, we talked about names meaning something. Elimelech, his name means my God. That's L-E-E-L and the I. I, in Hebrew, stuck on something, it means it's my. It's mine. L is God. L-L-I is my God. Melech is the word for king. My God is king. Now, what's kind of interesting is that if you remember some of the previous stories in Judges, remember, there was that phrase where there was no king in Israel, and every man did what was right in his own eyes. And yet the seeds of this story start with a man whose name is God. My God is king. That's kind of cool. I think that's very cool. He is married to a gal named Naomi. Her name means my delight. They have two kids, two wonderful kids. One of them is called Sick, and the other one is called Pining. Where's Pining? Now, I'm just wondering who in their right mind names their kids Sick and Pining. Kilion, Pining. He's just wasting away. And yet that's exactly what what will happen. That's exactly what will happen. It says that they are called, these are Ephrathites of Bethlehem. This word is kind of confusing because this word is used to describe descendants of Ephraim, one of the tribes. These people are not from Ephraim. They are from Judah. But you will see this word in the scripture used to apply to that. It's also used to describe those who live at a place called Ephrath, which is also known as Bethlehem. And that's an extension of this house of bread thing. Ephrath, meaning fruitfulness, and they are living in the place of the house of bread. Verse 3, then Elimelech, Naomi's husband, died, and she was left and her two sons. Wait a minute, did I skip something? Okay. Then Elimelech, Naomi's husband, died, and she was left and her two sons. Verse 4, now they took wives of the women of Moab. The name of the one was Orpah, and the name of the other was Ruth. And they dwelt there about 10 years. Take wives from the women of Moab. Now, that's not necessarily a good thing. Because if you remember the history between Israel and Moab, it was those Moabite girls that got the Israelites into major trouble before they crossed the river into the land of Canaan and conquered it all. That's at all the end of Numbers. That's what Balaam told them to do. So here's this guy taking his family across the river, and they end up marrying Moabite girls. It doesn't sound like a very good thing, does it? Doesn't sound like a good thing at all. The Moabite people worshiped the god Chemosh, and they worshiped another god. They did not worship Yahweh. They had strange, weird stuff going on. When Israel was about to cross the promised land, it was the Moabites that caused them trouble. And as a result, God said, an Ammonite or Moabite shall not enter the assembly of the Lord, even to the 10th generation. None of his descendants shall enter the assembly of the Lord forever. Now, it's not expressly forbidden for a Jewish boy to marry a Moabite girl. That specific thing isn't commanded. But the Moabites and the Ammonites were trouble. And God says, I don't want them to come to church for a long time. For a long time. I don't want to see these people around because they've been messing with you. So it's kind of a weird thing. It's a famine. They're marrying kind of some questionable people. They marry a gal named Orpah. Her name, one of the books I saw said her name was Gazelle. But when you look at the meaning of her, of the word, it means neck or back. And the Jewish sages say that they called her Orpah because she turned her back on Naomi and left. That's what she's going to do. Sorry, that's a little bit of a spoiler alert. Ruth, her name means friendship. And what's interesting with this whole thing, because Ruth is the one, of course, Ruth is the one that the book's named after. She's a good girl. And there's a lesson here, gang, that God uses outcasts. Who would have thought that God would be using a Moabite, a dirty pig dog heathen Moabite? And yet that tends to be something that God does. He takes people who are unacceptable and he uses them. Gang, this is grace. This is grace. Now, I don't know about you. Maybe you think that God did a good thing by calling you. And maybe you think that God has been very blessed to have you on his team because you are so awesome and amazing. But I don't know about you. I kind of think the other way around. I kind of think, what in the world did you pick a jerk like me? Now, I'm probably the only one in the room that feels this way. I don't think so. But gang, God uses the outcasts. He uses them. This woman is listed in the genealogy of the Savior, Matthew chapter 1. Down there in verse 5, by Ruth, the genealogy of Jesus Christ, this Moabite, God uses Ruth. He makes a point of it. He makes a point of saying that he's using her. Now, it says they took the boys there and they lived there for 10 years. That's kind of quite a while. I don't know that I've ever noticed that before. They're there for 10 years. They're not just there for 3 months to get married and then they go back. They're there for 10 years. They're settling down. It says, verse 5, then both Mahlon and Chilion, sick and pining, die. So the woman survived her two sons and her husband. Mahlon and Chilion die. Was it a mistake for Elimelech to take his family to Moab? Think about that. Was it a mistake to take his family to Moab? I've read commentaries from people who say, well, he's left the promised land. I'm personally thinking, gosh, the grocery store shelves are empty and the fields are all, you know, cracked dry. I would think that he's trying to keep his family alive. But I've read people who've said that he made a mistake. And you can kind of see he leaves the promised land. Sojourning is something you typically do for a couple of months. They stay for 10 years. He stays so long. His boys marry Moabite girls, those girls from across the tracks. They marry them. People move in times of famine because they don't want to die. But he dies and his boys die. So let me ask you the question. Was it a mistake for him to go to Moab? Yeah, I don't know. I like Greg's answer. I don't know. Here's where I'm at this point in my life. Now that I've been a Christian for about 40 years, life is just messy. And I think sometimes we make judgments on people that just are not fair. Sometimes, gang, life is just messy. Even when you make what seems to be all the right moves, all the right decisions, sometimes bad stuff still happens. It does. Sometimes it does. I got to tell you, I have never seen in the scriptures condemnation on Elimelech going to Moab. I don't think I've seen anything that said that he did a bad thing and God was against him because he went to Moab. Sometimes we make what seem to be bad decisions. Sometimes we look back at our decisions, we wonder, why did we choose those things? I'm not trying to make an excuse for poor decision making. But sometimes, gang, it's better to make a decision than sit there and do nothing. To get what my pastor used to call analysis paralysis. You know, where you're just so worried about making a bad decision that you do nothing. Sometimes that's the worst thing to do. How's that then add to your analysis paralysis? So do I go left or right, or do I do nothing? Now he says, I can't do nothing, so I got to go left or right, or I don't know what to do, and we work ourselves into a tizzy. Gang, sometimes life is just messy. And sometimes your best growing times will be through the difficult times. We want to make choices that make life painless and easy, don't we? I mean, really, isn't that where we're really going? I want to choose, you know, path A or path B. I don't know. Monty Hall says, you know, do I want door number one, door number two, or door number three? And all we can think about is which one has the biggest prize. Well, maybe the smallest prize is what's really, in the long run, best for you. Even though you could make a case for the trip of Moab being a disaster, if Elimelech hadn't taken his family to Moab, there would be no Ruth. And I have to tell you, Ruth is good. The Bible says we know that God works all things together for the good, for those who love God, and to those who are called according to his purpose. Verse 6. Talking about Naomi, it says, then she arose with her daughters-in-law that she might return from the country of Moab, for she had heard in the country of Moab that the Lord had visited his people by giving them bread. So now Bethlehem is once again the house of bread. There's bread on the table in Bethlehem. Let's go home. Verse 7, therefore she went out from the place where she was and her two daughters-in-law with her, and they went on the way to return to the land of Judah. And Naomi said to her two daughters-in-law, go, return each to her mother's house. The Lord deal kindly with you as you have dealt with the dead and with me. The Lord grant that you may find rest each in the house of her husband. So she kissed them and they lifted up their voices and wept. Now, she's releasing them. She's saying, look, girls, you don't have to come with me. I release you of any sense of obligation to hang out with me and to be with me. She's hoping, the language she's using in verse 9, she's hoping that they get remarried. She's hoping that they can find some more husbands. Verse 10, and they said to her, surely we will return with you to your people. But Naomi said, turn back, my daughters. Why will you go with me? Are there still sons in my womb that they may be your husbands? Turn back, my daughters, go, for I am too old to have a husband. If I should say I have hope, if I should have a husband tonight and should also bear sons, would you wait for them till they were grown? Would you restrain yourselves from having husbands? No, my daughters, for it grieves me very much for your sakes that the hand of the Lord has gone out against me. Now, she says she's too old to have a husband. What she means is she's too old to have kids. That's what she's talking about. Why is she saying that? Because she talks about this, there's no sons in my womb. There is what we call in the Old Testament, we call this the Levirate Law. It has nothing to do with the tribe of Levi. Levir is the word, I think it's the Latin word for a brother-in-law. So this is the brother-in-law law. So, but it sounds cooler to say Levirate than to say brother-in-law law. There is a tradition. It starts off as a tradition and eventually becomes a law under Moses that concerns the death of a spouse. If a couple gets married and they don't have kids and the guy dies, if the guy had a brother, according to this Levirate law, the brother has the responsibility to marry the other woman and to have kids with the other woman, and the kids become, carry on the name of the dead brother. It's a way of carrying on the dead brother's name. So under this law, if you are a guy who has a brother and your brother's about to get married, you want to make sure he marries somebody that's okay. You got it? Because you could end up with her. You know, this could happen. You see this with Judah, who is one of Jacob's sons. Judah had three sons, Onan, and a fellow named Shelah. And it's kind of a strange, it's like a gal named Sue or something like that. Anyway, gets married to a gal named Tamar, and he goes up and dies. He doesn't have any kids yet. So Judah picks up Onan by by his collar and says, go marry the gal. And he kind of doesn't do that. He's not real excited about it. And then he dies. And Judah's getting to wonder about this. He's kind of wondering, is this in the girl's cooking? You know, why are two brothers dead? I've got one more son. Am I going to give him to her? And he says, you know, Tamar, the third kid's a little bit young. I think we should wait a while. Why don't you go home to your daddy's house and just wait for the other boy to grow up? And that's a whole story. That's in Genesis 38. It becomes from a custom to a law in Deuteronomy 25. And I want to read this because some of this will play into the story next week. It says, if brothers dwell together and one of them dies and has no son, the widow of the dead man shall not be married to a stranger outside the family. Her husband's brother shall go into her, take her as his wife, and perform the duty of a husband's brother to her, which means get her pregnant. And it shall be that the firstborn son which she bears will succeed to the name of his dead brother, that his name may not be blotted out of Israel. But if the man does not want to take his brother's wife, because he just might not like her, you know, then let his brother's wife go up to the gate to the elders, it's like going to the county courthouse, and say, my husband's brother refuses to raise up a name to his brother in Israel. He will not perform the duty of my husband's brother. Then the elders of the city shall call him and speak to him. But if he stands firm and says, I do not want to take her, then his brother's wife shall come to him in the presence of the elders, remove his sandal from his foot. We learned in the Iraqi war, little bits and pieces about what happens when you take somebody's shoe off, especially if you throw it at somebody. It was a great insult, right? Did you remember that? Remember the news conference where some Iraqi reporter threw a shoe at President Bush? Remember that? Okay, this is very similar along those lines. Take a sandal off his foot, spit in his face, and answer and say, so it shall be done to the man who will not build up his brother's house. And his name shall be called in Israel the house of him who had his sandal removed. That's Joe is had his sandal removed. Cathers. You know, that's what they would call him. Now, you're going to see some of this play into the story. You're going to see sandals removed. You won't see the spitting because Ruth is, you know, a bit too nice for that. You know, but you will see some of this play into the story. Verse 14. Then they lifted up their voices and wept again, the daughters. And Orpah kissed her mother-in-law, but Ruth clung to her. Orpah kisses her. She kisses her goodbye. She kisses her goodbye. But it says Ruth clung to her. Now, I saw something here that I didn't think I've ever seen before, and it's stupid because I've been a pastor for a long time, but I guess old dogs can learn new tricks. It says Ruth clung to her. The word for clung is dabak. It can be translated to cling, to stay close, to cleave, to keep close, to stick with, to follow closely, to join to. If you look at the first place in the scripture that dabak is used, it's in Genesis chapter 2, verse 24. Therefore a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife. King James, cleave to his wife. And they shall become one flesh. We talk about, you'll hear Greg Laurie talking about this. Marriage is about leaving and cleaving. You leave your old relationships and you cleave to your spouse. You leave and you cleave. The word for cleave is this word, debak, translated here that Ruth clung to her. She clung to her. I got to tell you that I've had it wrong in my head. I've looked at Genesis 2:24 and thought that the cleaving was just a nice word for sex. You know, cute little word for sex. It has nothing to do with sex. I mean, sex is involved in marriage, don't get me wrong. But debak is not about sex. The word is found 52 times in the Old Testament, 52 times. It's a useful word. And it's not about sex, it's about joining. It's about staying close to, about drawing alongside of somebody. Those are the ideas of this. Now, sex comes into marriage in Genesis 2:24, and they shall become one flesh. But if you notice, it's you leave father and mother, you leave the important relationships, you cleave, you join with your wife. We're a team. We are together. We're tied at the hip. We're with each other. And because you've left, because you cleave, then you get to do the fun stuff. Okay? But it's not like the one flesh is just a reiteration. They're three separate things. Marriage is about commitment. It's about connection. And you're going to see, and in fact, I've always wondered why some of the verses found in Ruth are quoted in marriage ceremonies. And now I actually realize there's actually a really darn good reason. Because of debak. Because it's the same word that's used about a husband and a wife. And in fact, if you want to say it this way, I think this is a good way to say it. Ruth fleshes out, she defines what cleaving is all about in just a few verses. And we'll see that in just a few verses. Says verse 15, Naomi says, and she said, "Look, your sister-in-law has gone back to her people and to her gods. Return after your sister-in-law." This is what Naomi is saying to Ruth. She's saying, "Look, girl, look, you don't need to hang around here. Go ahead and go back. See, look, Orpah's going and it's okay. I'm going to be okay. You go ahead and go." And what I love about this is that Naomi is giving Ruth a chance to change her mind. She's not laying a guilt trip on her. You know, some of us would do that. We'd say, "Oh, it's okay that Orpah goes, but you know, if you go, I'm probably going to die." You know, and we lay these, you know, we manipulate people to do what we want them to do. What you see Naomi doing is she's letting her go so that whatever she decides, it's Ruth's decision. It's Ruth's choice. She's not having her arm twisted in this. She's the one making the choice. I like that. Verse 16, "But Ruth said, 'Entreat me not to leave you or to go back from following after you, for wherever you go, I will go, and wherever you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people, and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there will I be buried. The Lord do so to me, and more also, if anything but death parts you from me.'" Where you go, we're doing that on Sunday, aren't we? Where you go, I'll go. Where you stay, I'll stay. We'll give you a little definition of what that song's all about here this evening. This is all about, this gives us the nature of commitment. This is what commitment is all about. Committing to a person. And I see five things in here. I see these applying to marriage. I see these things applying to our commitment to Jesus. I think they apply to a lot of different kinds of commitments, but I'm going to just kind of talk about these kinds of things. Five aspects about Ruth's commitment, and I'm just pulling this from the text, so I'm not giving you my ideas of commitment. I'm telling you what Ruth's ideas of commitment. First, where you go, I'll go. Sometimes commitment is about going. Sometimes things and relationships change. People need to move from one place to the next. And commitment in marriage means that when you move, I'll move with you. When you need to go and make a change, I'm there with you because I'm ready to go with you. Sometimes life It means that even if I'm comfortable staying where I am, I will move because I want to be with you. Not just location, sometimes career, all kinds of changes. Where you go, I'll go. I'm willing to go. A relationship with God ought to be the same way, shouldn't it? Remember what God said to Isaiah, who will go for us? Who will I send? And Isaiah said, here am I. Send me. Sometimes commitment is about going. Sometimes commitment is about staying. Because you know what, gang? Life is not about making changes every 6 months. Some of us, we just like to go a little bit too much. And we don't like to stay put when we need to be staying put. Sometimes the thing to do is to stay. Sometimes life gets hard. And sometimes we need to stay through the difficult things. I am convinced. I got to spend time with a college group a couple weeks ago, and I was sharing out of Romans chapter 8. And we're talking about trials, talking about difficulties. And the truth that I think I'm actually starting to get it. I don't say I've arrived there, because I've only been a believer, you know, a few years. But I think I'm starting to realize that the greatest times of my growth are the difficult ones. Those are the times that I grow the most, is when life is the hardest. And I learned to stay, not run. You know, Deb wrote a song a few years ago about I want to run. Boy, does that resonate with me. Because there's sometimes when things are just so stinking hard, and I don't want to see this person, you know, I'm having trouble with somebody at church or family or whatever, and I just want to run. And yet how I grow is by learning to stay. You understand? Sometimes commitment's about going. Sometimes it's about staying. Sometimes it's about people. Your people will be my people. Now, I've heard people say to their spouse, I married you, not your mother. Or, I married you, not your family. Have you ever heard that phrase? You know, I kind of get that. There's some truth to that. It's important to have some kind of distance with the in-laws. It is. It's good to not have them calling all the shots. That's kind of what marriage is about, leaving and cleaving. You leave, you break some form of the connection with the parents. I get that. But you can't separate a person entirely from their family, because their family is a part of who they are, whether you like it, whether they like it or not. I have seen these ugly cases where one spouse works to completely alienate their husband or wife from their family. Completely alienated. Against the family's wishes, against the spouse's wishes. And they and I have no idea that behind the psychology behind that. I don't know how that works. I'm just not sure that's a good thing. I'm not sure that's a healthy thing. Whether you like it or not, your spouse's family is a part of who they are. It's a part of what you have bought into as a marriage. I'm not saying you can't keep a healthy boundaries. But you know what? It's you can't just lose people. When we cling to God, when we cleave to God, your people are my people. Now, sometimes that's a good thing. And especially when you're kind of new as a Christian and you come to church and people are hugging on you and loving on you. And some people it's like, ooh, what? Too much over here, too much. I get that. But it's kind of a neat thing, isn't it, to have a family? But sometimes, if you've been in church, you know, long enough, you will run into people that you kind of wish they weren't part of the family. You know what I'm talking about? You know, there are people like that in every family. And there are people like that in this family. but our commitment to God. Your people are my people. And you can come up with excuses and say, well, they aren't really God's person. Oh, yeah, they are. If they think they are, you gotta go with that. Your God will be my God. That's the reason why we don't do marriages between believers and unbelievers. Because marriage is about a joining of gods. And if they are not a believer, Paul writes in 2 Corinthians, he says, chapter 6, verse 14, do not be unequally yoked together with unbelievers. For what fellowship has righteousness with lawlessness, and what communion has light with darkness? Now, if you are married to an unbeliever, and you've come to Christ, and this is the way you are, you're a believer and they aren't, there's nothing you can, I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about people entering into a relationship. Because a strong commitment is a commitment between gods. You want to make sure that their God is your God. You want God to be the center of your marriage. It says, and the last thing about commitment is till death. It's like we'd stick that in the marriage thing. You know, I'm doing a wedding on Saturday, and so I'll make them say that line, till death do us part. You know, you know, but that's the way our commitment in marriage ought to be. Because I made you guys say that, didn't I? I made you say that. Yes, Mark raises his hand. I did. He said that. That's what commitment ought to be about. That's the way our commitment ought to be to God. I mean, we never really have to worry about till death do us part, because death just brings us home. So this is what commitment is. The nature of commitment: go, stay, people, God, death. Verse 18. When Naomi saw that she was determined to go with her, she stopped speaking to her. She was determined. I like this quote from John Wesley. See the power of resolution. Those who are half resolved are like a door ajar, which invites a thief. But resolution shuts and bolts the door, and then the devil flees from us. I like that. When we are undecided about things, we're leaving the door open, and the enemy can come in. God wants you to make a choice about things in your life. Verse 19. Now the two of them went until they came to Bethlehem, and it happened when they had come to Bethlehem that all the city was excited because of them, and the women said, "Is this Naomi?" No, it's been 10 years, and actually it's probably not been a good change in Naomi. And they're saying, is this Naomi? And she said to them, do not call me Naomi, call me Mara, for the Almighty has dealt very bitterly with me. Naomi, her name used to mean my delight. Is this my delight? And she said, girls, stop calling me that. You need to call me, I'm going to change my name to Mara, which means bitterness. She's become a bitter woman. She's bitter over what's happened to her life. I went out full, verse 21, and the Lord has brought me home again empty. Why do you call me Naomi, since the Lord has testified against me and the Almighty has afflicted me? So Naomi returned, and Ruth the Moabitess, her daughter-in-law, with her, who returned from the country of Moab. Now they came to Bethlehem at the beginning of the barley harvest. The beginning of the barley harvest is around the end of March. And she said in verse 21, she said, the Lord has, is that the one I want? The Lord has afflicted me, is her phrase in verse 21. I want to talk a minute about dealing with bitterness. We talked about Sunday about the danger of allowing bitterness to stay in our hearts. Hebrews 12 is the verse, looking carefully lest anyone fall short of the grace of God, lest any root of bitterness springing up cause trouble, and by this many become defiled. Bitterness causes trouble and it defiles people. The elderly couple had been married for 50 years, 50 full years of misery. They had fought every day of their marriage. It was the typical standoff. She said she would change when he did, and he said he would change when she did. The couple's children threw a 50th wedding anniversary party for them. After the celebration had ended and the guests were gone, the wife turned to her husband and said, We've lived together for 50 years, but it's been miserable. We've fought every day. She paused. Now I think it's time. In fact, it's time to change. In fact, I've been praying that things would change. I've been praying that the Lord would take one of us home. And when he answers my prayer, I'm going to go live with my sister in Grand Rapids. Okay, let me try another story. An old missionary couple had been working in Africa for years and were returning to New York to retire. They had no pension. Their health was broken. They were defeated, discouraged, and afraid. They discovered that they were booked on the same ship as President Theodore Roosevelt, who was returning from one of his big game hunting expeditions in Africa. No one paid any attention to them. They watched the fanfare that accompanied the president's entourage, with passengers trying to catch a glimpse of the great man. As the ship moved across the ocean, the old missionary said to his wife, "Something is wrong. Why should we give our lives in faithful service to God in Africa all these years and have no one care a thing about us? Here is this man comes back from a hunting trip and everybody makes much over him and nobody gives two hoots about us." "Dear, you shouldn't feel that way," his wife said. "I can't help it. It just doesn't seem right." When the ship docked in New York, a band was waiting to greet the president. The mayor and other dignitaries were there. The papers were full of the president's arrival, but no one noticed this missionary couple. They slipped off the ship and found a cheap flat on the east side, hoping the next day to see what they could do to make a living in the city. That night, the man's spirit broke. He said to his wife, "I can't take this. God is not treating us fairly." His wife said, "Why don't you go in the bedroom and tell that to the Lord?" Short time later, he comes out of the bedroom, and now his face is completely different. His wife said, "Dear, what happened?" "The Lord settled it with me," he said. "I told him how bitter I was that the president should receive this tremendous homecoming when no one met us when we returned home. And when I finished, it seemed as though the Lord put his hand on my shoulder. And he simply said, 'Well, you're not home yet.'" I like that last song we did, Dan picked out. "Jesus, you're all I have. All I have is you." And you know what? Others may have this or that. But you know what we're looking for? We're looking for him. Because we're not home yet. We are not home yet. You may go through changes in life, but you are not home yet. Beloved, guard your hearts from bitterness. We're going to see a change in Naomi. Last thing I'm going to say about this idea is don't quit. Naomi doesn't see it now. She doesn't see it now. All she sees is the devastation that's occurred to her family. That's all she can see. And she doesn't realize the treasure she has right underneath her nose. Danny Sampson used a hand-me-down Colt 45 to rob a bank in Canada, getting away with $6,000. When the Mounties caught up with him, they confiscated the gun and sent it to their laboratory, where it was recognized as a collector's item. And Danny discovered he didn't have to rob a bank. His gun was worth $100,000. Just like Naomi's going to have to do, you got to wait till the end of the story, Gabe. You got to hang in there. Don't quit. She may be bitter now, but we're only in chapter one. Now, am I going to be able to do a whole other chapter in 7 minutes? I take that challenge. Chapter 2, verse 1. There was a relative. Huh? I take that challenge. There was a relative of Naomi's husband, a man of great wealth, of the family of Elimelech. His name was Boaz. He's a relative. And we're going to see that there are laws about helping your relatives, and Boaz is a relative. The writer informs us he's a kinsman. But keep in mind, through the story, at this point, Ruth knows nothing of this. He's a man of great wealth. That's helpful. That's a helpful thing. And his name is Boaz. Boaz means fleetness. I don't quite understand what that has to do with him. I'm just throwing that out since we've been doing lots of definitions. We have this notion that Boaz, that there's an age difference between Boaz and Ruth. They're not both 20-something, I don't think. We think that Ruth's probably in her mid-20s. Boaz might be a little bit older now, maybe not quite that much older. You know, some people think maybe he's in his 40s or something. I don't know. But just kind of keep in mind, because he will make a comment about, I just don't understand why you didn't go after the young men, which means apparently he is not a young man. So there's some kind of an age difference. So Ruth the Moabite said to Naomi, please let me go to the field and glean heads of grain after him in whose sight I may find favor. And she said, go, my daughter. Now, she wants to go glean. Now, there's this Old Testament law that says that when you own a field and you go to reap your field, you can't pick up every last little kernel of grain. You've got to leave some of it for the poor people, for the widows, for the orphans, so that they can go into your fields and glean, which means to pick up the leftovers. That's how the poor were fed, by doing work, by working for themselves and picking up the leftovers. That's what gleaning is all about. And so Ruth is going to go out into the fields because it's harvest time. Remember, it's harvest time. So she's going to find a field that will let her glean in it and see if she can bring home some food for her mother-in-law. So, verse 3. Then she left and went and gleaned in the field after the reapers, and she happened to come to the part of the field belonging to Boaz, who was of the family of Elimelech. Says she happened to come there. Here's a good definition. You might want to write this down. Coincidence. When God does a miracle and remains anonymous. I like that one. I like that one. When God does a miracle and remains anonymous. It just happened to wander into Boaz's field. Coincidence of coincidences. Verse 4. Now, behold, Boaz came from Bethlehem and said to the reapers, the Lord be with you. He's using God's name, Yahweh. Yahweh be with you. This is a godly man. And they answered, Yahweh bless you. Then Boaz said to his servant who was in charge of the reapers, whose young woman is this? He doesn't recognize this girl. So the servant who was in charge of the reapers answered and said, it is the young Moabite woman who came back with Naomi from the country of Moab. And she said, please let me glean and gather after the reapers among the sheaves. So she came and has continued from morning until now, though she rested a little in the house. Then Boaz said to Ruth, you will listen, my daughter, will you not? Do not go to glean in another field, nor go from here, but stay close by my young women, the gals that work for me. Let your eyes be on the field which they reap, and go after them. Have I not commanded the young men not to touch you? And when you are thirsty, go to the vessels and drink from what the young men have drawn. Now, you know, she doesn't have her own Aquafina bottles with her or anything, you know. She doesn't. And so she, you know, how do they keep people from dehydrating out in the field? You got to hydrate somehow. So they'd be bringing buckets of water. It'd be kids, that's their job. He says, look, you use some of our water. I've told the young men, because young men can be kind of nasty if a woman's out there all on her own and she's a good looking woman. And I've commanded everybody, don't touch this woman. So she fell on her face, bowed to the ground, and said to him, why have I found favor in your eyes, that you should take notice of me, since I'm a foreigner? And Boaz answered and said to her, it has been fully reported to me all that you have done for your mother-in-law since the death of your husband, and how you have left your father and your mother and the land of your birth, and have come to a people whom you did not know before. Yahweh repay your work, and a full reward be given you by Yahweh, God of Israel, under whose wing you have come for refuge. He says, it's been fully reported to me what you've been like. He didn't know who she was because he hadn't seen her yet, but he's heard all about her. She has a reputation. The Bible talks about how important a good reputation is. Proverbs 22:1, Choose a good reputation over great riches. Being held in high esteem is better than silver or gold. And Ruth has a good name because she's been a faithful woman. She's taken care of her mother-in-law. Verse 13, then she said, let me find favor in your sight, my Lord, for you have comforted me and have spoken kindly to your maidservant, though I am not like one of your maidservants. Now Boaz said to her at mealtime, come here and eat of the bread and dip your piece of bread in the vinegar. So she sat beside the reapers, and he passed parched grain to her, and she ate and was satisfied and kept some back. Now, he says, dip your piece of bread in the vinegar. He's giving her lunch. They've got a lunch truck that comes out, you know, one of those roach coaches pulls up, you know, he's feeding his workers. And he says, girl, we'll let you eat with our guys, you know. And the same practice went on in Jesus' day. You're seeing dipping a piece of bread in the sauce. That's what happened at the Last Supper in John chapter 13, where Jesus is with the guys, and they ask, who's going to betray you? And Jesus says in John 13, he says, it's the one who's going to dip his hand in the bread. And so he takes a piece of bread, dips it in the sauce. It's kind of like chips and salsa. You know, Jesus takes his chip, dips it in the salsa, and gives it to Judas. And what we don't really get in our society is that was a gesture of friendship. That was a gesture of love. And when you read about how Satan enters Judas, it's probably because Judas is thinking, yeah, okay, but I am not letting you love me. What Boaz is doing, same thing. He's sharing a meal with her. There's something going on. And says she kept some back. She's eaten her fill, but she didn't quite eat all of her part. She took a doggy bag home because she wanted to make sure that Naomi gets some food. So that's the idea. She kept some back. And when she rose up to glean, verse 15, they went back out to work, and Boaz commanded his young men, saying, let her glean even among the sheaves, and do not reproach her. Also let grain from the bundles fall purposely for her. Leave it that she may glean, and do not rebuke her. And the idea is this. Normally the gleaners just pick up the few scattered grains that the harvesters leave. But he's saying, no, just, you know, let her help you guys out. In fact, take handfuls of stuff and drop it for her. You know, drop piles of stuff for her. It says, let bundles fall purposely. There's a phrase here that I really love. It's in the King James, it's called handfuls of purpose. And you'll find there are books out there, some of them came out in the early 1800s, that you will use this title. It's a beautiful picture because it's a picture of God taking handfuls from his word and dropping it at our feet and teaching it. So it's kind of a cool concept. And it comes from here, from the book of Ruth. That's the only reason I'm pointing it out, is some of you bibliophiles who like to read will probably see books called Handfuls of Purpose. It comes from this concept. So she gleaned in the field until evening and beat out what she had gleaned, and it was about an ephah. It was about an ephah of barley. An ephah comes out to be about 30 pounds of grain. The normal gleaner comes, you know, with a little lunch sack full of stuff that they pick up after working all day. She comes back with this big old honking thing. And it kind of gives you a taste of who she is. She is a hard worker. She doesn't take it easy once she finds out that Boaz is being nice to her. She works hard. She's a virtuous woman, like Proverbs 31. Says she watches over the ways of her household and does not eat the bread of idleness. You're going to see in Ruth a hard working lady. I think that's part of the formula of God working in her life, is her willingness to work hard. Verse 18, she took it up and went into the city, and her mother-in-law saw what she had gleaned, and she brought out and gave to her what she had kept back after she had been satisfied. That, in other words, she brings out the doggy bag and gives Naomi some of the leftovers. And her mother-in-law said to her, where have you, would you rob a bank? What'd you do? Where have you gleaned today? That's the Hebrew there. where have you robbed a bank today? And she brought out and and where did you work? Blessed be the one who took notice of you. So she told her mother-in-law with whom she had worked and said, the man's name with whom I work today is Boaz. His name was Boaz. He didn't look very fleet of foot, but you know, that's what his name is, you know. And Naomi said to her daughter-in-law, blessed be he of the Lord, of Yahweh, who has not forsaken his kindness to the living and the dead being the relatives who've died, whose names have yet to be raised up. And Naomi said to her, this man is a relation of ours, one of our close relatives. Now, we're going to talk about the close relatives, the kinsman redeemer thing. We'll look at that next week. We're not going to get into that this week. In other words, he's a special guy. This guy is more than just a nice guy. He's got some potential here. And Ruth the Moabitess said, he also said to me, you shall stay close by my young men until they have finished all my harvest. And Naomi said to Ruth, her daughter-in-law, it is good, my daughter, that you go out with his young women and that people do not meet you in any other field. Girl, just keep going to the same place. So she stayed close by the young women of Moab to glean until the end of barley harvest and wheat harvest, and she dwelt with her mother-in-law. Now, remember, barley harvest started around March. The end of barley harvest and the wheat harvest. Barley harvest ends in April, and the wheat harvest will end in July. So she's going to spend quite a few months there out in the fields. She's got herself a nice little job for a couple of months. And it says she dwelt with her mother-in-law. You know, she's not just the person who stays when things are rough, because some people will do that. Some people will stick it out just because it's rough and it'll help you over the rough times. But now things are looking up, and she still stays with Naomi. I like that. There's another good lesson. Let's stand.